Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading Cowboys and Indians magazine. Black Bear Bosun. If you've been to Wichita, Kansas, you've no doubt seen the Keeper of the Plains. At the confluence of the Big and Little Arkansas rivers, the statue rises monumentally from its pedestal, a Native American in a headdress with face upturned, arms upraised, thanking, imploring, protecting. It's the work of Francis Black Bear Bosun, who was also known by his Kiowa name, Satekunjia, meaning black bear. Born in Cyril, Oklahoma, near Anadarko in 1921, Black Bear Bosun made his home in Wichita from the age of 19 and eventually set up his studio there. The statue honors his Comanche Kiowa roots. Designed in 1968, it was conceived to share his culture with Wichita, where the Mid-America All-Indian Museum has mounted an exhibition as part of its two-year Bring the Bosun's Home campaign to collect and care for his original art. Bosun's path to settling permanently in Wichita and committing to art had a few switchbacks. He got married and had children young. To provide for his family, he turned down a college art scholarship and instead attended a trade school to learn sheet metalworking. When he enlisted in the Marines, while on the troop ship headed to Hawaii, he became ill and had to be hospitalized. It was then that he returned to painting. While in rehab in Honolulu, Bosun, who had worked primarily in watercolor up to that point, discovered gouache. He would use the more opaque technique throughout his life until eye problems necessitated a switch to acrylics. His style evolved from static, flat representations to a more flowing, symbolic approach. A fellow Marine suggested he sign his work with the name Black Bear. Following his discharge and divorce in 1946, Bosun set up shop in Wichita. That same year, he entered the Philbrook Art Center's first Indian Artists Annual, where an honorable mention for his painting Green Corn Dance prompted more painting, exhibitions, and competitions. The early 1950s were a time of discovery and development that found Bosun learning more about his Indian heritage and becoming more serious about his art. As he became more accomplished, he began winning awards and recognition. In 1951, at Denver Art Museum, he won the Purchase Prize. In 1952, at the Philbrook, he received first place for Death Bird. In 1953, again at the Philbrook, he won first place for Prairie Fire. Prairie Fire puts him in the art world map when National Geographic published it as a centerfold with a lengthy accompanying article. Next to the Keeper of the Plains in Wichita, it remains the work most closely associated with the artist. We talked to David Simmons, author of Black Bear Bosun, Keeper of the Indian Spirit, about the artist's life and legacy. Black Bear certainly had a storied career. What was he particularly proud of? Although he got the most recognition for the sculpture he did, the Keeper of the Plains, in Wichita, that was his only sculpture. He clearly identified himself as a painter. I think one of the highlights of his career was when his painting Prairie Fire was the centerfold in National Geographic in May of 1955. The magazine had a major article on Native American art, and Prairie Fire was chosen to be the two-page center spread. After that appeared, requests for reprints of the painting, which was owned by Philbrook in Tulsa, came in from all over the world. That painting was hailed, basically, as a new beginning in Plains Indian art, because prior to that, the paintings tended to be motionless. Black Bear himself did a number of paintings of katsina dancers and fire dancers and subjects like that, but there was no sense of movement in the work. Prairie Fire showed incredible movement, both of the horrible fire itself and the running of the animals and the Indians on horseback. It was a very significant painting, and it was recognized as such. Prairie Fire hung in the White House for a period of time. Another big recognition came 10 years later when he was invited to the White House. One of the big recognitions for him as an artist came in 1965 when he was the only Native American invited to the White House Festival of the Arts, which was hosted by President Lyndon Johnson and Lady Bird Johnson. I love the story about Lady Bird being so taken with Black Bear's outfit that she invited him to her table. Yes, his cummerbund and bow tie were beaded by his mother, actually. Lady Bird noticed them and invited him to be seated at her table. That was a major thing. Imagine what it meant to get to that table. The other people at that table included Helen Hayes, Duke Ellington, and Gene Kelly. Black Bear brought home the program of the evening, and it was autographed by Gene Kelly. Any interesting backstories you can share about his work? He did all his paintings at home. He owned a commercial art studio for a number of years, but his paintings he did at home. I would say it probably took about a month to do a painting. Of that month, about half the time was spent reading. Once, fairly early in his career, there was an exhibition of his paintings somewhere, and an obviously Caucasian fellow came up to him and asked him what tribe those Indians were that were in the painting. Black Bear was fairly flippant, I guess, so he said, "Kiowa, Comanche," which was what he was. And the guy said, "Well, that's odd, because they're wearing Sioux moccasins." At that point, Black Bear decided he needed to be much more meticulous in his background for his painting. Over the years, he acquired a very large library of books about American Indian history, and before he did a painting that was focused on some Indian ritual, he spent a lot of effort getting the details right. You're not just the author of a book about Black Bear Bosun. You're his stepson by his marriage to your mom, Nola Simons. What was it like for him to be around day to day? He was pretty easygoing. During the week, he spent his time down at the shop. His art studio actually moved from one place to another because of urban renewal. That's where he spent most of his work week, doing commercial art. Particularly in his last gallery on North Douglas, he had the front set up as a sort of lounge area with display cases with North American art of all sorts. He sold jewelry. Of course, his paintings and prints were for sale there, along with pottery, beadwork, and beadwork supplies, because there wasn't much available in the Wichita area. He tried to keep supplies available for folks who wanted to continue the Indian crafts. How did he deal with it when he developed eye problems near the end of his life? I think it depressed him, certainly. He coped with it as best he could, but it changed his style of painting. He could not do the detail he had previously done in his paintings. Toward the end of his life, he changed from using gouache to using acrylics. The acrylics were more forgiving, I guess you'd say. There's a quote in a magazine interview where the guy interviewing him asked him what effect it had on him, and he said, "If I tilt my head the right way, I can make an entire building disappear." It was like a horizontal band across his vision. And he was still relatively young. For all the health problems he experienced, he still had an amazing career. Yes, he considered himself to have two contemporaries in American art, Alan Hauser and Oscar Howe. There was a period of time when Alan Hauser, Black Bear, and Oscar competed head-to-head at the Philbrook's yearly Indian art competition. Bring the Bosuns Home, The Journey Continues, is on view through June 4th at Mid-America All-Indian Museum in Wichita, Kansas. Boson was one of the founders of the museum, which houses the largest public collection of his artwork in the world. The museum's Boson Society has been actively locating and securing donations of the artist's work to archive it for posterity. TheIndianCenter.org. Claire Thomas. From Wales to Wyoming to the war, whether she's embedded in Iraq or writing in the West, for photojournalist Claire Thomas, it's always been about horses. Growing up in a small village in South Wales, Thomas was obsessed with horses from the age of 4. "I must have seen Horse and Pony magazine," she says. "My parents gave in and let me have riding lessons, and I got my own pony at 11. I would go out riding around the country lanes by myself and take part in local show jumping competitions." Thomas credits her time in the saddle, in particular the 6 summers she spent as a wrangler at the Lazy L&B Ranch in Wyoming, starting in 2006, for everything she's become. An award-winning photojournalist whose work has graced National Geographic, the New York Times, the Sunday Times, and The Guardian, among others. A fine art photographer. A war photographer. A photographer of animals. Horses especially. "I attribute my photo career to Wyoming because it was there that I started to take it seriously," she says from her apartment in New York, where she lives part-time when she's not in the UK. "Before that, I had a digital point-and-shoot, and I printed off some of the snaps I'd taken and showed them to my boss at the ranch, Heath, who was my idol. His words of praise were hard to come by, and he said, 'I think you should get a real camera.' That was the encouragement I needed." She spent a few years learning the basics from books, and she kept shooting everything she saw around her in the West. The rich culture, the interesting people, the majestic landscape, and the horses. "Whether I was on a bucking horse or baling hay, I didn't go anywhere without my camera. I remember thinking that photography was what I wanted to do, but I had no idea how to make a living out of it. So I kept going back to the ranch, and I was able to naturally develop my photography skills. It was already in her," she says, "to capture something authentic and have an approach of storytelling with her photography. I wanted to capture the natural images of what I was seeing without manipulating or staging any scenes. I also love taking pictures of beautiful things." Working 12-hour days alongside a handful of other wranglers, she was able to chronicle what she saw not as an observer but as a participant. "As a photographer, it's always about access," she says. "You have to be in the right place, and because I was living and breathing the ranch life, that gave me a fairly unique perspective of what it was like day to day, and to tell that story through photography." Since those first summers in Wyoming, Thomas, now 38, has traveled extensively, sharpening her photography and storytelling skills. Since working extensively in the American West, where one of her subjects was cowboy artist John Finley in Dubois, Wyoming, she has trained her lens on everything from women living with HIV/AIDS in Ghana to Khaza eagle hunters in western Mongolia's Altai Mountains to frontline medics treating casualties in Mosul, Iraq. She spent 3 years in northern Iraq covering the war. "When I was in Mosul, it was very tough," she said. "Besides the mental challenge of witnessing trauma, it was uncomfortable wearing all of the body armor and helmets in the heat. When I was at the ranch, I never thought I'd be able to lead a 9-hour ride. But I toughened up in many ways. I learned to read the landscape and not get caught up on following trails, to know when it was time to head up to the mountain and when to go down the valley. So the physical demands of working the ranch helped prepare me for working in a war zone. Even in Iraq, there were horses. I was living in Erbil, and they had this international horse show jumping club. They asked me if I would take photographs of the event. It was such a juxtaposition to the war. I had my motorbike, and I would happily ride out to the club. I even took part in a show jumping competition. Horses are just so healing. Visit Claire Thomas online at ClaireThomasPhotography.com. Renting the West. Looking for a place to get away? Experience Western living at its finest with these dreamy vacation rentals that blend top-notch amenities with inspiring design. By Rhonda Reinhart. Southwest Wonder, Tucson, Arizona. As owners of the Joshua Tree House, a 1949 hacienda and neighboring casita in Joshua Tree, California, Sarah and Rich Combs were already veteran Airbnb hosts and home remodelers when they discovered an abandoned inn on the western edge of Arizona Saguaro National Park. Left neglected for more than a decade, the 1970s-built five-suite inn needed major repairs and a whole lot of updating. But the place had good bones, and it was situated on 38 idyllic acres with a glorious canyon-style pool and native plants galore. For Sarah and Rich, the inn's pros outweighed its cons, and the couple soon got to work renovating and reviving each space, filling the rooms with the modern desert flair for which their other vacation rentals are known. Now the property, renamed JTH Tucson, is once again a haven for families, friends, and couples looking for a serene desert escape that's as uplifting to the eye as it is to the soul. Rent the entire inn, up to 14 guests, or a single suite. Rates from $2,200 per night for the full inn, from $196 per night for an individual suite. The inn features several cozy common spaces, like this light and bright sunken living room, where guests can meet new friends or spend quality time with old ones. Woven pendants and salvaged wood ceiling beams add warmth to the white walls and upholstered seating, while a contemporary art piece by Julia Kostreva Rosenthal and a menagerie of patterned rugs and pillows pep things up with a little pops of color. Outdoor spaces abound on the property, including the main rooftop patio, which offers treetop views and plentiful seating areas. The property also features multiple private outdoor spaces, as well as a shared outdoor lounge with a fire pit, a shared dining space that seats up to 14, a stone surround hot tub, and a pool. While each of the suites at the inn comes equipped with a full kitchen or kitchenette, this shared kitchen adjacent to the shared living room is a great space for groups large and small to gather and cook. When the Combses found the property, the kitchen was in complete disarray, missing cabinetry, some flooring, and some walls. But many of the room's charming details were already in place, including the natural light, the oversized fireplace, one of 13 on the property, and the ceiling made from saguaro ribs and reclaimed telephone poles. Guests may also book chef-prepared private meals in advance. Every sleep space at the inn has been designed for maximum comfort. All the suites are decked out with at least one cozy fireplace, and every bed features a mattress, pillows, and linen sheets by Arizona-based Tuft and Needle. The rooms also aren't short on wow-worthy design moments, from the Yucca Room's mustard yellow headboard by California-based Norwegian Wood and matching beehive fireplace, to the sand-colored Choya Room, accented with a vintage Moroccan rug from Suki Modern, and a cute woven desk chair from Serena and Lily. Desert Dream, Pioneer, California. Deep in Southern California's Mojave Desert, on a 120-acre tract surrounded by mesas, L.A.-based residential designer Jeremy Levine pulled off an architectural feat so impressive that describing it required new terminology. dubbed by Levine as Cowboy Modernism, the design style of the 1,200-square-foot house, built as a retreat for the designer and his family, but available for short-term rental through Airbnb, is a contemporary take on the ranchland structures that populate the area. I wanted to capture the Old West in a modern building, Levine says. I wanted to make the house feel like it belonged in the desert. To balance the steel and glass of the modern eco-friendly abode, Levine used locally sourced reclaimed lumber inside and out, giving the home a weathered look that helps it blend into the landscape. He also designed the sloped, standing seam metal roof to echo the silhouette of the mountains in the distance. Aside from its design, the property is notable, too, for its total solitude. We're in a canyon, so you don't hear a thing, not even a distant car. I can't romanticize it enough. It's magical. Rates from $740 per night. HawkandMesa.com. In an effort to minimize disturbance to the property's desert ecosystem, Levine opted for a zero-waste system when building the house, prefabricating parts of the structure off-site and therefore reducing construction waste and build time. The sustainable home, situated in Pipes Canyon near Joshua Tree National Park, is a 10-minute drive from Pioneer Town, an 1880s-themed community founded in 1946 by a group of Hollywood investors, including Roy Rogers and Gene Autry. The community, which eventually became a real town, served as a living movie set for films and TV shows throughout the 1940s and 50s. The open layout of the light-filled great room, which includes a kitchen, living, and dining space, makes the home feel larger than its modest square footage, while the large windows and glass doors connect guests to the landscape both visually and physically. The room's polished concrete floors, clean white walls, and exposed ductwork give the space an industrial vibe, which is toned down by the salvaged wood ceiling, as well as the earth-toned and natural wood furnishings. The sleek kitchen features IKEA cabinets, Caesarstone countertops, and KitchenAid appliances, and the living room comes equipped with a smart TV and Bluetooth speaker. To create the ultimate indoor-outdoor living experience, Levine included 1,000 square feet of covered porches. The house's roof overhangs form a shaded wraparound deck that stretches the length of the house, with areas for outdoor grilling, dining, and lounging. The designer also oriented the house to minimize solar heat gain and capture the natural breezes that flow through the canyon. The lounge chairs, dining table, and dining chairs are all by IKEA. The home can sleep up to 4 guests in 2 bedrooms, which are positioned on opposite ends of the house for maximum privacy. Both bedrooms feature luxurious sattva mattresses and offer distinct patio access and magnificent views of the surrounding nature. In fact, the house is oriented so that every room has a different but equally majestic view. The home also has 2 bathrooms, both with walk-in showers and a washer and dryer. To further the home's eco-friendly mission, all gray water from the sinks, showers, and washing machine is recycled for irrigation. A boulder-lined concrete path leads from the house to a jacuzzi brand hot tub and cowboy tub, a nod to the Old West practice of repurposing galvanized livestock troughs as bathtubs. Both of the tubs, like the house itself, are clad in reclaimed lumber. Other outdoor amenities include an outdoor shower, a hammock, a custom fire table, a propane-fed barbecue grill, and at night, a sky full of stars. Thanks to the property's lack of light pollution, stargazing is an unparalleled outdoor activity. Farmhouse Fresh, Round Top, Texas. For the past 10 years, design-minded treasure hunters who travel from all over the country to shop Round Top's famous antique shows and explore the tiny town's burgeoning food and drink scene have flocked to the vintage Round Top. What started as a single cottage, a renovated 100-year-old farmhouse just a mile from town, has turned into a collection of four cottages, all sporting a unique twist on the modern vintage design aesthetic owners Paige and Smoot Hull first perfected a decade ago. Available to rent through Airbnb, VRBO, and the Vintage Roundtop website, the property's lodging options include number 1450, the original 2,400-square-foot farmhouse, Boho, a 2,000-square-foot cottage with a more modern bent, and a duo of cozy 400-square-foot studios. What all the cottages have in common is an inspiring mix of modern and vintage design elements, including one-of-a-kind gems the Hulls have found everywhere, from the streets of Paris to the fields of Round Top. "A lot of what's in Boho is from shopping trips to Paris," Paige said. "Other people see it as decor, but when we're there, it brings back memories. We remember exactly where we bought that particular item and the ice cream we ate afterwards. It's things like that we hope will inspire people, showing the soul of the pieces and how they attach to our story." Rates vary depending on the cottage and the day, but the high season antique show rate for number 1450 is $750 per night, and for Boho, it's $825 per night. TheVintageRoundtop.com. In Boho's 900-square-foot great room, a vaulted ceiling accented with reclaimed wood beams give the space an open and airy feeling, while the mix of seating arrangements make it comfy and cozy. The New England white pine floors might appear vintage, but they're actually brand new. The Vintage Roundtop sits on 1.5 acres on the main road that leads into and out of Roundtop. The property's two main lodging spaces, number 1450 and Boho, are connected by a shared mudroom, which can be locked if the house is being occupied by two different parties or left open if one party wants to rent both houses. The Hulls enlisted Houston-based architecture firm MaRS, Mayfield and Ragney Studio, to help them take an empty garage and transform it into the serene Boho cottage. Old doors taken from a cotton gin in the South Texas town of Devine separate the great room from the kitchen, where brass countertops by Houston Custom Metalworks add a glam touch to the modern vintage space. The doors can be closed if needed, a detail that appeals especially to the many guests who rent the house for retreats, workshops, and other events. C&I's Kurt Russell cover shoot took us to Will Rogers Ranch and namesake State Historic Park in California. The influence and legacy of famed cowboy philosopher Will Rogers could be felt everywhere as cover star Kurt Russell joined the C&I crew and photographer Robert Linden in Pacific Palisades, California. They captured the images for this issue's cover story at what is now the Will Rogers State Historic Park. Before its historic designation by the state, it was a home and ranch developed by the beloved writer, actor, and entertainer who rose to the heights of worldwide fame before his untimely passing in a 1935 plane crash. These days, the parkland, the ranch house, and more are open for visitors. Rogers' great-granddaughter, Jennifer Rogers Echeverry, serves on the board of the Will Rogers Ranch Foundation and is involved in that group's mission to help preserve and maintain the historic state park. Here's more from Rogers Echeverry on the foundation's efforts and the park itself. On discovering her heritage, Back in 1991, my grandfather took all the family to New York for the opening of Will Rogers' Follies on Broadway. That's where I caught the fever, and I wanted to learn more. I was blessed that my grandfather lived in Bakersfield, where I did, and I just began to shadow him and go to things and learn. I'm still learning, but because I only live a couple hours from the ranch down in Santa Monica, I was able to travel down there quite often and get more involved on the Will Rogers Ranch Foundation. Around 2005, we had a rededication of Will Rogers State Historic Park. State parks were budget crunching, and our park was threatened. So I, along with another good friend, Trudy Sandmeyer, formed the nonprofit Will Rogers Ranch Foundation. We are a cooperating association with California State Parks to raise money to help maintain the ranch. On visiting the park, the ranch house is open to the public. Everything in the house is authentic, and what the family left behind or donated to the state. There's hiking, a horse concession that offers trail rides and horseback lessons, and polo played on the last remaining grass polo field in the Los Angeles area from April through September. There's always something happening at the ranch. People can come and hike, mountain bike, ride horses, or just have a picnic. On Will Rogers' legacy. For somebody who's been gone 87 years, he has all these amazing places across the United States named after him. But sadly, a lot of people no longer know who he was. I think that the hardest part is pulling out those fun facts and his quotes, many of them still relevant today. He made more than 70 movies. He authored 6 books, had a daily newspaper column that reached more than 40 million readers. He was the number one at the box office. He did all this, and he was only 55 years old when he passed. There's just never been anybody to match what he did.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading from True West Magazine, History of the American Frontier, May 2022 edition. Death Valley, The Dalton Gang's Deadly Demise, by Ron Sudalter. For a brief period, toward the end of the 19th century, the mere mention of the name Daltons was enough to send paroxysms of terror through the towns of the frontier West. Ruthless to a fault, they robbed and murdered at will, outwitting or outrunning hundreds of law enforcement officers, until the crisp October day in 1892, when a group of citizens, in defense of their town, their money, and their lives, brought them down in a flurry of gunfire. Indian territory in the 1870s and 80s, all 74,000 square miles of it, was a sinkhole of criminal activity. Bootleggers and whiskey runners sold illegal rot gut to the Indians. Highwaymen robbed with abandon, and deaths by gunfire were frequent and often unpunished. Further exacerbating the situation, gangs and individuals who had committed felonies in the states often crossed into the nations, as the territory was more familiarly known, seeking to evade the law's reach by losing themselves in its vastness. Only a small number of deputy marshals riding out of Hanging Judge Isaac C. Parker's court in Fort Smith were assigned the impossible task of keeping order. By the early 1890s, most of the infamous miscreants from other parts of the so-called Wild West, Jesse James, Billy the Kid, Clay Allison, Cole Younger, had met bloody ends or were securely behind bars. Still, the nations continued turning out bad men in sufficient numbers to keep the marshals busy. Of these, the most notorious was by far the Dalton Gang. They would ride out of their various hideouts in the nations, terrorize the citizens of Kansas, Texas, New Mexico, and pre-statehood Oklahoma, and rob trains and banks with abandon. The gang was a loosely structured band of brigands, the numbers fluctuating as members came and went. At various times, it included such larcenous luminaries as Bitter Creek Newcomb, Blackface Charlie Bryant, a near-miss pistol shot had permanently powder-burned his face. The narrow-gauge kid, Bill Powers. Dick Texas Jack Broadwell. And the redoubtable Bill Doolin. The core of the gang, however, were the three Dalton brothers, Grat, Emmett, and the gang's leader, tall, handsome Bob. A fourth brother, Bill, rode the outlaw trail as well, but he only occasionally accompanied his brothers, preferring to work out of Oklahoma and his home state of California. The three boys were born in Cass County, Missouri, to Lewis and Adeline Dalton, on land left to Adeline by her father. Although she was a member of the notorious Younger family of outlaws, she was never known as anything but respectable and hardworking. Lewis, however, was a fiddle-footed ne'er-do-well and often left Adeline to provide for her family. After producing 15 children, the couple separated, and even before Lewis died in 1890, Adeline was raising her large brood on her own. By all reports, she was a kind and diligent mother and a good provider. One older boy, Frank, served as a deputy marshal, and, as were so many who wore the badge for Judge Parker, he was killed in the line of duty while shooting it out with a band of horse thieves. Eventually, Adeline would have to live to bury four of her sons who had died of gunshot. Bob, Grat, and Emmett briefly tried their hands at law enforcement and found the job provided an ideal opportunity to pilfer, sell whiskey to the Indians, and generally disgrace the office. Inevitably, they were fired and immediately turned their attention to outright banditry. Gang of Thieves. Robert Riddick Bob Dalton was clearly meant to be the leader. In 1890, 22-year-old Bob, clever, ambitious, and a noted marksman, organized the band of brigands that would become known throughout the West as the Dalton Gang. All evidence points to the fact that older brother Grat, described by one biographer as having the heft of a bull calf and the disposition of a baby rattlesnake, was the slowest of the three. Or, as another historian puts it, downright dense. For his part, youngest sibling Emmett idolized his big brothers and followed them sheep-like on whatever hijinks Bob concocted. On their first outing as a gang, they rustled three horse herds in the nations and sold them in Kansas, just a few jumps ahead of a posse of Judge Parker's deputy marshals. They would soon graduate to train and bank robbery, leaving the occasional corpse in their wake. Soon, significant rewards were posted for their capture, motivating such intrepid lawmen as Deputy Marshal Heck Thomas and Wells Fargo's Fred Dodge to doggedly pursue the gang. Then Bob allowed hubris to direct his plans. It needled him that the now-defunct James Gang had grown to legendary status, and he formed a plan to surpass their boldest deeds. He would rob two banks at one time, a feat that Frank and Jesse never dared attempt, and he chose Coffeyville, Kansas, as his target. The Dalton family had lived near Coffeyville for a time when the boys were very young. The town's two banks, diagonally situated from one another across a plaza at the V-junction of Union and Walnut Streets, the First National, and the impressive two-story red brick Condon. Since the brothers were familiar with the town, the choice seemed ideal. Selecting Bill Powers and Dick Broadwell to accompany them, they saddled and rode for Kansas. Fatal decision. The Coffeyville of 1892 was a far cry from the wild saloon and gambling mecca of its trailhead days of two decades earlier. It was now a respectable, bustling community that catered to farmers and businessmen, as well as cattlemen and cowboys, and contained several mills, a cheese factory, barber shop, livery stable, and family restaurants. It also boasted drug, hardware, lumber, dry goods, blacksmith, and shoe stores. In fact, years earlier, Adeline had bought shoes for her boys at the shop of George Kubine. On the morning the Daltons chose to rob Colleyville's two thriving banks, an urban development project was well underway to add curbs and gutters to the street fronting the banks. As a result, the street had been torn up, and all the hitching posts, including the one nearest the banks, where the gang had planned to tie up their horses for a fast getaway, had been removed. Although at the time this seemed like a minor inconvenience, it would soon prove to be a grave and fatal mistake. Because the Daltons were known to several of the townspeople, they rode into Coffeyville wearing false beards and sideburns. All five men were heavily armed. In a display of pre-victory largesse, Bob had bought each of them a pair of factory-engraved, pearl-handled, 45-caliber Colt revolvers. He himself carried three pistols, but it was their Winchester repeating rifles that would play a deadly part in the drama that was about to unfold. When they found the street devoid of hitching rails, the five rode into a narrow passageway behind several buildings and tied up to a wooden fence. This unremarkable stretch of ground would soon earn the grisly end an accurate epithet, Death Valley. The outlaws were now well over 100 yards from their two objectives across an open plaza. Unlimbering their rifles, they divided into two parties. Gratt, Powers, and Broadwell entered the Condon Bank, while Bob and Emmett, still wearing their crude fake whiskers, strode into the First National. It was around 9:30, and the streets outside the banks were growing increasingly busy with foot, horse, and wagon traffic. At first, no one paid them any mind. It was hunting season, and the sight of men carrying rifles in town was not uncommon. Then, dry goods merchant Alec McKenna, who was familiar with the brothers, recognized Gratt as he crossed the plaza. McKenna watched as the five split up, carefully following Gratt and his two cohorts as far as the outside of the Condon Bank. Peering through a large plate glass window, he observed one of the men leveling his rifle at the clerk. The gang no longer possessed the element of surprise as McKenna set about raising the alarm. Men immediately dropped what they were doing and either grabbed their own weapons or rushed to Isham's hardware store where the proprietor was handing out firearms and ammunition. Citizens took up positions around the plaza, sighted in on the banks, and waited. Inside the banks, things were not going well for the would-be robbers, who were completely unaware of the reception being prepared for them just outside the doors. After cashier Charles Ball filled a grain sack with money from the counter and cash drawer, Gratt demanded that he open the vault. Displaying incredible presence of mind, Ball ran a dangerous bluff. He told Gratt that the vault was on a time lock and would not open until 9:30. When Gratt asked what time it was, Ball pretended to consult his watch and responded that it was only 9:20. Ball was risking his life to save the bank's funds. Had any of the three bad men looked up at the large wall clock, they would have seen it was 9:40 and the vault was already open. Still unaware of the flurry of activity outside, Gratt, in a stunning display of what one chronicler labeled his glacially slow wit, decided to wait. Meanwhile, in the First National Bank, bookkeeper Bert Ayers, despite Bob's repeated threats to shoot him, was responding to the outlaw's demands as slowly as possible. And when Bob ordered Ayers to open the safe, he answered that he didn't know the combination. Bob and Emmett finally accumulated some $20,000 in gold and paper money. Thus far, no one had been shot, and all that remained was the dash across the plaza to the horses. Forming up the three bank employees and four customers in front of them, they walked out the front door and into the sights of the townspeople's rifles. Suddenly, the street erupted in gunfire. As dozens of citizens dove for cover, Bob's prisoners ran into the street as the two other brothers jumped back into the bank. Round after round entered the building as the defenders fired from doorways, rooftops, and any form of cover they could find. Gratt and his men were still dallying in the Condon Bank as dozens of bullets suddenly poked the walls and holed the windows. One round caught Dick Broadwell in the arm, rendering his Winchester useless. Shortly thereafter, a hardware store worker placed a round in Bill Powers' chest. A citizen later recalled looking in the bank window and seeing the outlaws running back and forth, and I thought of rats in a trap seeking a way out. If the outlaws had done proper reconnaissance, they would have known that the bank had a back door, which would have removed them from the immediate line of fire. At the First National, Bob Dalton did see a back door, and, using the bank teller as a shield, he and Emmett exited the building into a vacant lot. They immediately encountered young Lucius Baldwin, who mistook the outlaws for fellow citizens. After a sharp warning to the confused Baldwin to drop his pistol, Bob shot him down. He was the first townsperson to die that morning. In the exchange of shots, the outlaws were managing to do a fair amount of damage. Either Powers or Broadwell had shot hardware employee Arthur Reynolds in the foot before being wounded himself, and Bob's Winchester was taking a fearsome toll. He shot one man through the hand and fired three rounds into the back of a bootmaker and old family friend George Kubine. And when Charles Brown, a 59-year-old shoemaker who worked alongside Kubine, reached to grab his dying friend's rifle, Dalton shot him dead as well. Death Valley. At the Condon Bank, Gratt finally decided it was time to make a dash for the horses. He stuffed a wad of paper money inside his vest, and the three outlaws ran out of the bank toward the mouth of the alley, across a plaza that was alive with gunfire. One observer later commented that they ran with heads down, like facing a strong wind. Almost at once, Gratt and Powers were hit hard, Powers for at least the second time, but the three managed to stagger into the alley. The roar of the firing was constant and deafening, and combined with the screams of wounded and dying men and horses, the town presented a fair impression of hell. Bob and Emmett were providing their cohorts with what covering fire they could, and when Bob spotted bank employee Tom Ayers, he shot him through the head. Miraculously, Ayers would survive to tell the story for years to come. The alley now became the focus of the townspeople's fire, as the bandits desperately strove to reach their mounts. Powers received yet another round, killing him beside his horse. Broadwell was shot again as well, but managed to keep his feet. Gratt, badly wounded but still able to fire his rifle, managed to find what sparse shelter the alley offered. And when Charles Connolly, the town's much-loved marshal, entered the alley, Gratt fatally shot him in the back. Livery owner John Clure, who was acknowledged to be the town's finest marksman, drew a bead on Gratt Dalton and shot him through the throat, breaking his neck and killing him instantly. Dick Broadwell actually managed to mount his horse, but two townsfolk opened up on him at close range with rifle and shotgun. Somehow, Broadwell stayed in the saddle, clutching the horn as he rode out of the alley, only to fall dead in the road less than a mile outside of town. Unaware of the fate of their three comrades, Bob and Emmett made for the alley and their horses. Years later, Emmett recalled that his big brother was still confident of leaving Coffeyville alive. "Go slow," Bob advised. "Go slow. I can whip the whole damn town." Immediately upon entering the alley, Bob was hit and collapsed against a pile of cobblestones, still firing his rifle. Once again, John Clore leveled his deadly weapon and shot Bob in the chest, leaving him out of the fight and dying. Incredibly, up to this point, young Emmett had come through unscathed. Once in the alley, however, he was hit at least twice, one of the shots fracturing his arm. Still carrying the money sack, he mounted one of the two horses left standing amid the withering fire. He was hit several more times, but managed to stay aboard. As he started to ride out of the alley, Emmett saw his dying brother, and he did an extraordinary thing. He turned his horse back into the hail of bullets. As he later wrote, "All thought of money, of my own life, or of escape vanished. I only knew that I had to reach Bob." Depending on which version one credits, Bob either said, "It's no use," or in Emmett's more florid recollection, "Goodbye, Emmett. Don't surrender. Die game." In all likelihood, he said nothing at all. Either way, Emmett's was a brave but futile gesture, and for a brief moment, no one fired. Then, as he reached for Bob's hand, a shotgun roared, and Emmett fell into the dust of the alley that had already seen the finish of both his brothers and his two comrades. Someone shouted, "They're all down!" Suddenly, the guns, which had roared steadily since the battle began, were silent as the townsfolk began to survey the damage. "Death Valley," wrote one chronicler, "was a charnel house." Still conscious, Emmett was taken to the doctor's office amid cries calling for his immediate lynching. The doctor assured the citizenry that a rope was unnecessary, since the youth was bound to die soon anyway. Beyond all expectation, Emmett, who had sustained no fewer than 25 wounds, survived. Boards were immediately set up in the alley, and all four dead outlaws were unceremoniously hauled over to them, laid out side by side, and photographed. Souvenir hunters snipped pieces of their bloody clothing, and when the townspeople had had their fill of staring at them, they were buried in plain coffins in the local cemetery. Until the late 60s, their only marker was a random lead pipe someone placed ignominiously on their grave. Dick Broadwell's family soon claimed his body, but the other three lie there still. Shortly after their internment, the long-suffering Adeline came to town, along with two of her other sons, to pay her last respects to her wayward children. Wrote one historian, "Adeline was courteous and quiet, and apparently was treated politely and sympathetically by the people of Coffeyville." One of the sons who accompanied Adeline to Coffeyville was Bill Dalton, who railed at the town over the deaths of his brothers. "The boys were wrong in their purpose," he acknowledged, "but they were right when they shot the men who were trying to kill them." Bill later formed his own outlaw gang with Oklahoma badman Bill Doolin, and himself fell to lawman's guns less than 2 years later. Bill's grave is unmarked in his wife's family plot in Turlock, California. Blaze of Glory. The citizens of Coffeyville had displayed considerable heroism on the day the Dalton gang targeted their town. For his part in subduing the outlaws, John Clore was presented with a factory-engraved rifle, a gesture of the Winchester factory. A humble man, Clore, for the rest of his life, refused to discuss the fight or his part in it. A number of others, equally brave, went unheralded. With hundreds of rounds shot, the entire fight had lasted no more than 10 or 12 minutes, but the butcher's bill was terrible. In addition to the four slain outlaws, as a result of the chaos the Daltons had levied on the town, four of Coffeyville's leading citizens lay dead, and several others were injured. While still recovering from his many wounds, Emmett Dalton was sentenced to a term of life imprisonment in the Kansas State Penitentiary. However, after spending 15 years behind bars, a rehabilitated Emmett received an unconditional pardon. He lived into his late 60s, during which time he produced two historically skewed volumes on the Dalton gang, one of which inspired the first of several Dalton-themed movies. and became something of a Hollywood celebrity. He also ordered a headstone to be placed over the graves of his brothers and Bill Powers. While most Western history buffs would likely be hard-pressed to name even one of the four citizens who died protecting their town that bright October morning, the sanitized myth of the Daltons continues to flourish. Two photographs of the dead outlaws recently sold at a Western collectibles auction for over $6,000. And less than a decade ago, one of Bob Dalton's pair of fancy engraved Colts hammered down at $322,000. Ultimately, for the Daltons, crime did not pay. However, the wake they left continues to generate considerable public interest, as well as revenues far beyond what the gang ever dreamed of acquiring through larceny. Americans, indeed, love their outlaws. The terrible tally. Four outlaws killed. Four citizens killed. Four horses killed. Four wounded. Adeline and Lewis Dalton had 15 children, 10 boys and 5 girls. Of the 12 who lived to adulthood, one of the boys, Frank, died as a lawman, while four of his brothers he had deputized from time to time turned to outlawry. The outlaws are Bob, Emmett, Grat, and Bill Dalton. Littleton and his brothers, Ben, Cole, and Sam, lived straight and narrow lives. Ron Sudalter is an award-winning author with 3 books and over 400 articles in print. He currently serves as the chairman of the board of the Abraham Lincoln Institute. Ron currently lives in Cold Spring, New York.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.